Funding for Think comes from SMU Master and Doctor of Liberal Studies programs.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. It's September of 1906, and you've just paid for what's been advertised as a once-in-a-lifetime excursion to the Bronx Zoo in New York. As you and hundreds of others press up to the display portion of the primate house, you see what everyone's been talking about. Caged together with a parrot and an orangutan, staring blankly at the swarming throng, sits a diminutive young man, perhaps not out of his teens. A so-called pygmy taken from his home in Congo, almost surely without giving true consent, the man known as Ota Benga was displayed among animals at the zoo for weeks that New York autumn with the approval of some of the most respected scientists of the day, until the dismayed outrage and tireless activism of some black clergymen helped secure his freedom. New York University journalism professor Pamela Newkirk traces the sad course of his bizarre journey in her new book, Spectacle, The Astonishing Life of Ota Benga. Pamela, welcome to Think.
Thank you for having me today.
This story, I have to tell you, is so outrageous that I found myself actively wishing it wasn't true as I read. How did you first hear about Ota Benga?
Well, I wanted to look at race at the turn of the 20th century, but I wanted to look at it in New York City, which is not often examined. We know about, you know, the epidemic of lynchings throughout the South, but very rarely have we looked at what was going on in cities like New York in the North. So I had heard about this episode and at first thought it may be too dark a window to look onto the rest of the city. But once I leaned in, I saw that it actually was the perfect way to look at what was going on in the city because of the response to this exhibition in New York City. And also, as you said in your opening, the most eminent scientists in New York City had supported this exhibit. So as it turned out, it showed us New York from all walks of life, from the highest to, you know, to the average zoo goer who went to see Ota Benga.
Yeah, this is as much a story about the society that made it possible, even acceptable, for this to happen as about this sad course of Ota Benga's life. These were not abuses carried out in the shadows. They were advertised.
Right. And unlike the human zoos that were very common during this period throughout Europe, Ota Benga was not exhibited with other humans. He was exhibited in the monkey house with an orangutan. He was locked in a cage. And the average zoo goer would have no reason to believe that he was fully human.
Hmm. What do we know about Ota Benga's early life in Congo?
Well, we know what was going on in the Congo during that period. This was during the brutal reign of King Leopold. When Ota Benga first came to the United States in 1904, he was captured in the Congo by Samuel Werner, a self-described African explorer, who was appointed a special agent by the St. Louis World's Fair organizers to bring back so-called pygmies to exhibit on the fairgrounds. So we know that during this period, the Congo was being plundered. Millions of Congolese were being killed, maimed in the name of civilizing them as Leopold enriched his own coffers. I mean, he owned the Congo. And so the Congo was a place where minerals and ivory and all sorts of treasures were being collected by Leopold and others who hoped to make their fortune on the Congo. And Samuel Werner was one of those people who saw it as an opportunity. So what we can know about Ota Benga is that he was in a really bad place. It was a time of wide-scale slavery, slaughter. So when he was brought to this country, he was brought by a man who went there heavily armed and who, when he came back to St. Louis, wrote an article for the St. Louis Post-Dispatch that was entitled something like, "How I Hunted Pygmies in the Congo."
I want to talk about that term for a moment. Otabenga was billed as a pygmy by his captors. To be clear, this term doesn't refer to a specific tribe or a culture. What did it imply?
Well, the word, if you look at the etymology of it, it was first used in Egypt to describe people that they called worshippers of the sun, little people who lived in the Central African forest. That was the earliest reference to that word. It was like something like pygmy. And then it referred to chimpanzee. It referred to monkeys. And then in Europe, it was then used to refer to these people, probably the same people in the Central African forest, diminutive forest dwellers who made their living hunting and gathering, and, you know, who did worship nature. And so they're known as a peace-loving people who lived the way their ancestors had lived for hundreds, if not thousands, of years.
All right, let's go back to talking about Samuel Verner, the man sent to collect Otabenga and other human specimens. He had like this just weird, disturbing history. Tell us what he was all about.
Well, he was from a slaveholding family in the South, and after emancipation, South Carolina, like much of the South, was trying to rebuild. Samuel Verner was the oldest I believe, 8 children, and he had his sights set on doing something great and trying to reclaim what his family had lost following emancipation and Reconstruction. So he was a self-described white supremacist who firmly believed that black people were inferior to whites. He first went to the Congo in the 1890s as a missionary for a Presbyterian mission, and he was pretty unsuccessful as a missionary. He finally was kind of asked to leave, and he went back in 1904 as an agent for the World's Fair. He had several bouts of mental illness. It's clear that he struggled throughout his life with mental illness. But he also was a prolific writer. His articles were published widely in magazines like Harper's and publications even in London, and he kind of made his way as an explorer, as someone and one of the few whites who during that time dared to go into the Central African forest to do the work that he was doing.
And as you mentioned, he went heavily armed. He, like, made this deal to go with a great deal of cash and a lot of weapons,
yes,
trying to find human beings that he could take back with him.
Exactly.
And he had
Which suggests that these people, you know, whether or not they were willing was kind of irrelevant, because he did go heavily armed. At one point, he even suggested maybe taking a cannon to lighten inferences to make it easier to accomplish his mission.
And he told multiple stories after he got back about how he managed to get Otabenga to come back with him. But in every story, the one like resounding theme is that he, Samuel Verner, is the hero here.
Right. He was the one who rescued Otabenga either from cannibalism, from slavery, from no matter what. He rescued him, and he and Otabenga were friends.
The cannibalism thing, that seems like something people were really obsessed with for a while. Is there evidence that was like a serious issue or a common practice at all?
No, it was never a common practice. I mean, there had been cannibal tribes that had been found in Africa and elsewhere, but it wasn't widely practiced. And in fact, certainly the people who Otabenga, you know, there was not one account of cannibalism practice among these so-called pygmies. But yet Otabenga was just one of the many people who Verner at some point claimed were pygmies, were cannibals. He claimed everyone pretty much was a cannibal.
Yeah, except him, the savior. Do we know, Pamela, how he communicated with Otubenga and the other people he brought back with him?
Well, because Werner had lived in the Congo as a missionary for a number of years, he probably could, you know, speak the language somewhat. And Otubenga and he probably communicated in that way. They did write letters. Werner, at least, wrote letters to Otubenga that were then read to him phonetically. It's unclear how much of it Otubenga actually understood, but I had found people who could translate the letters roughly, and so there's every indication that they did communicate somehow.
One has to wonder, of course, if Otubenga was physically intimidated. Can you describe him? He was not a large person.
Right. He was 4 feet, 11 inches tall, about 103 pounds when he was exhibited at the Bronx Zoo. So a pretty slight person, probably a teenager at that time. And intimidation, I mean, he was locked in a cage. Mm-hmm. So he didn't have much free will. The only time he was let out of the cage, he was let out with attendants at his side. So there was no chance for him to exercise free will. And when he did, it was clear that he resisted his captivity. He tried to fight his way, you know, bite, kick, do whatever he could to avoid being placed back into the cage.
And the people at the zoo somehow were shocked by this. The zoo officials, like, they were so disappointed that he was this intractable captive.
Right. I mean, he was like this unruly savage, of course, right?
The thing I have to tell you that shocked me as much as anything else in this very, very shocking book was this editorial in the New York Times saying, what does this guy have to complain about?
Yeah, it shows so clearly what mainstream ideas were at the time. Well, you know, Africans, according to the encyclopedia of that time, were midway between an orangutan and a human being. So these ideas of Africans as subhuman were deeply embedded into science, into, you know, history books, into it was the air that people breathed at that time. So the New York Times was reflecting that view when it questioned why anyone would protest Otubenga's exhibition in a monkey house.
How did Otubenga get from the exhibition at the St. Louis World's Fair to New York?
Well, that's kind of a circuitous route. First, he was taken back after the fair. He was taken back to the Congo. And then when Werner came back, he brought Otubenga back to the United States to go on a lecture circuit. And to, you know, he kind of had him as both his sidekick and as a specimen that he could show as, you know, a genuine savage, a genuine pygmy. So he went on the lecture circuit with Otubenga at his side. When he came to New York, he ran out of money, and he left Otubenga first at the American Museum of Natural History, where he lived in the basement for some time. And he tried to escape, and anyway, that's another long story. And he finally, from the Museum of Natural History, ended up being turned over to William Hornaday, who was the director of the Bronx Zoo. Werner was trying to sell him two chimpanzees, but when Hornaday saw Otubenga, he thought, yeah, we'll take the chimpanzees, but we'll also take the pygmy. And he was then, of course, exhibited.
Pamela Newkirk is my guest. She's professor of journalism at New York University and author of the new book, Spectacle, The Astonishing Life of Otubenga. You can join the conversation at 1-800-933-5372. You can email think@kera.org or find me on Twitter at Chris Boyd Think.
Mm-hmm.
Funding for Think comes from the SMU Master of Liberal Studies program. You can apply now for fall and design your own master's degree at SMU, a customizable evening master's degree for working professionals. More at smu.edu/MLS.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. We're speaking this hour with New York University journalism professor Pamela Newkirk, author of the new book Spectacle, The Astonishing Life of Oda Benga. You can join us at 1-800-933-5372 or email think@kera.org. Okay, Pamela, let's go back and talk about the museum basement. How did this arrangement happen and how did it come to an end?
Well, it happened because Sam Newverner was out of money and he was being chased by a sheriff for writing bounce checks. And he was trying to get a job at the museum as either a lecturer or a scientist or however they could use him. They kind of first considered it and then decided against it. And he asked if he can leave some of the specimens that he had brought back from Africa at the museum, and they said yes. And he also asked if he can leave Oda Benga for some time as he tried to find ways to raise money to get himself out of the hot water he was in. So Oda Benga was left at the zoo. At first, the director thought this was a great coup. He tried to show him around, and but then he found that he was unruly, as one would be when they were being held someplace against their wishes. Oda Benga tried to escape. He tried to walk out with visitors at one point. Anyway, after about a month there, they found a way for him to go to the zoo, and finally he was out of the care of the director of the Museum of Natural History, who had had enough.
We'll talk about the zoo in a minute. I want to go in for a moment to the question of why Oda Benga would have gone back with Werner the second time after being returned to Congo. As you mentioned earlier, the country was in terrible shape and had only grown worse in the time Oda Benga had been gone.
Right. And later, Werner did say that he offered Oda Benga the chance to either go back to America with him, or he would return him to a slave camp. So there you have it. He could certainly not have had good options.
How much English did Oda Benga have, and is it clear that he often, did he always understand what people intended to do with him?
Well, he probably did not always understand what people intended to do with him, but he clearly understood what was happening.
Yeah.
As it happened. When he was at the St. Louis World's Fair, they were often heckled and they were left barely clad, being exhibited on the frigid fairgrounds. They were chased. They were, poked and prodded. He was not a happy camper there. And just based on the descriptions of him in the Bronx Zoo Monkey House, he was not terribly happy there as well. So whether or not he understood the words, he definitely understood the actions of people, including the keeper of the zoo.
All right, so William Temple Hornaday is the director of the New York Zoological Park, known to most of us as the Bronx Zoo. What kind of reputation did he have professionally?
Oh, he was the most eminent zoologist in this country, also the founding director of the National Zoo in Washington, D.C., which he had lobbied for. He was also a close friend of Theodore Roosevelt. He was known for his realistic displays. He was highly regarded, renowned throughout this country.
How did he justify not just the exhibiting of Oda Benga, but the choices that were made with regard to how he would be put in front of all these thousands of visitors?
Well, they justified it in the name of science and anthropology, ethnology, right? That this was supposed to be something that was not only entertaining, but was also educational. people could see, you know, a real live primitive, you know, African. And it was left to park goers to determine how human he was, of course, because there he was exhibited in a cage in the monkey house with an orangutan. By the second day of the exhibit, Hornaday littered the cage with bones to suggest cannibalism. So he, on top of everything else, Hornaday was a showman, and he reveled in his latest display.
So much for science, right?
Yeah.
Were black visitors allowed at the Bronx Zoo in those days?
Yes, they were. And so the first day of the exhibit, fortunately for Otabango, one of the visitors was Reverend Robert Stuart MacArthur, who was a white Canadian Baptist minister of a church on West 57th Street, right across the street from Carnegie Hall. He was an eminent minister who was a confidant to presidents. He had written many books. He also ministered to the poor blacks in the area that was known as the Tenderloin District, that was in the West 40s, 50s of New York City. So anyway, he was this progressive, charismatic man who had missions across the world, and he is the one who first sounded the alarm on the exhibit, and he went to the black ministers who, you know, were in that neighborhood near his church. And it's because of his activism and his outrage that, you know, the protests began.
So these other ministers came together to begin protesting. They asked for an audience with the mayor and were basically told no.
Yeah, the mayor's too busy to meet. And the mayor, who happened to be an ex officio member of the New York Zoological Gardens as mayor of the city, he would not intervene.
Can you talk about some of the descriptions of what, I mean, sit us next to Otabenga and tell us what he would see each day as these visitors passed the exhibition where he was held captive.
Right. Well, I had the opportunity to visit the Monkey House before it was closed to the public. Now you cannot visit the Monkey House anymore. But I did have a chance to go in just to get a sense of what it must have been like for him. So it was, you know, cramped quarters. He was exhibited in the largest cage, described as a crescent-shaped cage, where the most visitors would be able to see him. Tens of thousands of New Yorkers and others flocked to the Monkey House each day. On one day alone, 40,000 visitors went to the Bronx Zoo, most, if not all, to see Otabenga. So, you know, attendance doubled, tripled during the time that he was there. So what he would have seen were crowds and crowds and crowds of people, you know, some heckling, some gasping, some, you know, laughing, jeering. So the full gamut of human emotions to this spectacle.
And then there was enough protest, I suppose, that Hornaday had him move outside the cage, but things were absolutely no better.
Right. So he was sometimes allowed to leave the cage under the care, of course, of a keeper, and who would take him out to the woods just to kind of get a break from it all. But once he was spotted by crowds, he would be chased and beaten and tripped, and, you know, and then he would have to be put back into the cage. So once again, just like when he was in the Congo, between a rock and a hard place, he was in between a rock and a hard place at the zoo. So either he would be subject to the violence of park goers, or he would be back in a cage in a monkey house being stared at by hundreds, thousands of visitors.
And numerous observers, including journalists, would note essentially like to look at this guy. He doesn't look any different than any African-American living in this country, which, of course, is to lead people to the assumption, I suppose, that there was something inherently, to use
exactly.
this word that you used before, savage about all people of African descent.
Exactly. And one New York Times article compared him to the orangutan, said that they looked the same, were about the same size, and grinned the same way when pleased. So, yeah, there were these comparisons between, you know, this person and an orangutan.
And people claimed he could talk to the orangutan.
Right, right. They claimed he spoke monkey talk.
Okay, so how did the deal finally take place so that an orphanage run by Reverend James Gordon was allowed to take custody of Otabenga and to care for him?
Well, after almost a month of the, you know, this daily spectacle and the mounting criticism that between the ministers who then rallied ministers across the country, and also there were a handful of whites who also protested. One was Hearst, the publisher Hearst. His newspaper was one of the few that called it a disgusting outrage. There was another businessman, John Milholland, who also offered to pay for Otabenga's legal defense. There was a lawyer, African-American lawyer, who was the first to argue a Supreme Court case, who was then hired by the ministers to, sue the city or the zoo or whoever to secure Otabenga's release. So because of the mounting criticism, legal action, and also not to be dismissed was Otabenga's own resistance to captivity. He was becoming increasingly difficult to handle. So because of this, he was finally turned over to the Howard Colored Orphanage Asylum in Brooklyn's Weeksville section, a African-American community of mostly upper-middle-class people.
And what was life like for him there, to think about being so traumatized and being finally in a safe place, but still not in a place that felt like home?
Right. Well, it was a caring place for sure. Many observers of the orphanage noted, you know, it's comfortable accommodations. It was a lovely house that was built probably about 10 years earlier. But as you say, I mean, he was still alienated from his country, from his people. If he did have any family that existed, he would not know what was going on with them. He wanted to go home, but he stayed at the orphanage for a while, where he was cared for and he was given his own room. And after a short time there, he was sent to Lynchburg, Virginia, to a seminary where the thought was that he could be trained as a missionary and then go back to Africa to help his people. But he got to Lynchburg, and his patron there, the head of the seminary, died suddenly, and Otabenga was sent back to the orphanage, which by then had a farm in Long Island, and they sent him to the farm where he worked on the farm.
Were you able to get a sense of how much agency he was ever given in making decisions about his own life?
Well, I think once he got to the farm, he worked at the farm. He was paid, and he was trying to save money. And he finally left the farm, and he got a job with a family of farmers nearby in Jamestown, Long Island. And so it seemed that he had agency, but he was also in a desolate place. He was, in this overwhelmingly white community, a rural area where he could not have had many friendships. Anyway, he was there working as a horse groomer and working on a potato farm and trying to save money to go back home. But it would have been pretty expensive for him to save enough money to buy a ticket that would take him, you know, through Europe, and then he would have to, from Europe, somehow get to the Congo. No small feat.
Did he receive any compensation, Pamela, for all of the torment and suffering that he endured as a captive and a exhibition subject?
No, he was not paid for his time at the zoo.
Did he? Were you able to get a sense for how he felt during the time that he was traveling with Werner? I mean, did Werner continue to think of himself as like a parental figure, and did they have like some way of coexisting, or was it always just awful and abusive? Can you explain what you understand of that relationship?
I think Werner really believed that Oda Benga was an inferior being. I mean, everything he had been taught, you know, during his upbringing in South Carolina would have told him that. He probably in his mind thought that he was. I mean, I know the paramount thing was himself and making money and finding a way to, you know, make a living as an explorer, as a scientist. And so Oda Benga was a means to an end. Whether or not he in some way felt any affection towards him, we couldn't know. There's just no way to know. I do know that he had brought two other Congolese children to the United States years earlier, and he admitted that he would beat them when he thought they were misbehaving. So I don't know. 100 years later, we can't know if he saw himself as just a caring guardian or if he was truly abusive.
Did Oda Benga ever learn to read and write in English?
I could not know. We do know he could speak. When he was at the zoo, they said he knew at least 100 English words. I don't know. I'm sure he learned how to write. Surely he learned some writing when he was at the orphanage. They said he was taught how to write his name. When he went to the seminary, he did go to school every day. How much he learned is not known. After some time attending classes, he did leave the school and he took on odd jobs and he worked at a tobacco farm.
Pamela Newkirk is my guest. She's professor of journalism at New York University and author of the new book Spectacle, The Astonishing Life of Oda Benga. You can join the conversation at 1-800-933-5372. You can email think@kera.org or find me on Twitter at Chris Boyd Think.
Funding for Think comes from the SMU Master of Liberal Studies program. You can apply now for fall and design your own master's degree at SMU, specializing in communications or organizational dynamics. More at smu.edu/MLS.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. My guest this hour is journalism professor at New York University, Pamela Newkirk. Her new book is called Spectacle, The Astonishing Life of Oda Benga. You can join us at 1-800-933-5372 or email think@kera.org. So, Pamela, you weren't able to ascertain whether Oda Benga read or wrote very much, and, of course, he didn't leave behind letters or diaries. I'm curious for you, as someone trying to fully understand this story, if you, at a certain point, felt like understanding the events of his life, you could fully connect with him emotionally, or whether there was often just a bit of a distance because you didn't have anything left in his hand or in his exact words.
Well, that's interesting. There were two independent accounts that suggest how intelligent he was. Two anthropologists who had visited him on the St. Louis World's Fair grounds, both in separate accounts, described him as highly intelligent. One of them, he taught her a sophisticated string trick that was included in her book on string tricks from around the world. So she described him as very bright, even though she also described him as a cannibal pygmy in her book. Then another anthropologist who first met Otabenga in St. Louis on the fairgrounds, and then because of his interest in the exhibit, went to the Congo, Frederick Starr, who was a University of Chicago anthropologist. He spent a lot of time with Otabenga in the Congo and also described him as highly intelligent, as he did many of the people that he encountered in the Congo. And it was a striking difference in the way he described them to how he had described other people he considered primitive. So from those two people alone, we know that we're dealing with someone who had at least normal intelligence, if not, you know, even higher intelligence than the norm. In terms of connecting to him, you know, first of all, as a human being, we can only imagine how it would feel to be hunted and captured and taken to a strange land and put on a fairground where you're othered, to be stalked and taunted and ridiculed, to want, you know, more than anything to go home and not have a way to do that, to not speak the language of the people who held you. So there are so many experiences that he had that made it very easy to connect to him just as a human being. You know, the way he was described, the way he looked when he was in the cage, you know, and all of the things that happened to him during his time in the United States. Yeah, I did, by the end of my research, feel a pretty strong connection to him.
There were some charming accounts from kids who had grown up in communities around the places where he lived after he was free.
Yeah, that, it was really lovely, the recollections of these children who, Otabenga became a beloved figure in the Lynchburg, Virginia community, but particularly so among the children who he would often take into the forest and teach them the ways of the forest, hunting and fishing and picking wild berries and making sassafras tea. But something that they also observed, he would perform this ritual where he would build a fire and he would dance and chant around it. And they didn't quite understand it. They didn't know the ancient, that it was an ancient ritual that had been performed by his people for centuries. But they did know there was something really sacred and poignant about it.
He, toward the end of his life, was pretty clearly disconnecting from everything that had at least kept him going until that point.
Right. You know, for like 6 years, he had been, as I said, this beloved figure in the community and a really close father figure, big brother figure to this band of boys. But during the last few months of his life, he had lost interest in, you know, taking them into the forest and telling them stories. He would often tell them stories about life in the Congo, you know, hunting elephants. But anyway, he lost interest in all of that, and he would just solemnly sit by himself under a tree and not speak to anyone. And when he did speak to people, he told them how much he wanted to go home.
Were you able to get a sense of what his spiritual beliefs were? It sounds like the dancing that he did around the fire and the chants were things that maybe brought him closer to God. Were you able to figure out through research what that was all about?
Well, yeah, there was a lot of research done on the so-called forest people, and one of the celebrations that they had was the celebration of nature, of the sun, of the moon, you know, of just nature. And that was something that was celebrated for centuries among the so-called pygmy forest dwellers. So it's likely the ritual that he was performing in Lynchburg. And it was like a spiritual experience, a religious experience, if you will. The so-called pygmies did not believe in evil spirits, or, you know, what they did was they celebrated nature.
Is it fair to assume that his well-meaning hosts in Lynchburg were incorrect when they thought that he would like to be a Christian missionary?
Yeah. You know, but that's not uncommon for people of any faith to try to, you know, get you to see things their way to save your soul, right? And there is an indication that he did sing some of the Christian hymns, gospel hymns. So maybe they weren't so off point, and he probably did recognize in some of the spirituals, some of the ways of his own people, you know, in the celebration of you know, here it was celebration of the Lord, and there was celebration of nature, and, you know, at the end of the day, it's pretty much the same, or could be seen as the same.
Local custom where he was from involved filing down one's teeth in a sort of...
Yeah, it was actually called chipping. Chipping. It looked like his teeth were filed into these points, but the actual practice, which was documented by this anthropologist, Frederick Starr, is that it was a process of chipping away, and you know, there were these practitioners who people would go to who, you know, were experts at the practice of chipping, and it was considered a, you know, a conceit no more daunting than having your ears pierced. And in some villages, it was a sign of courage, in others, just a sign of you know, a young man and being a handsome. They say in some villages, a woman wouldn't marry you unless your teeth were chipped. But unfortunately for Otabenga, in the construct of the United States, it allowed Samuel Verner to depict him as a cannibal savage, and his sharp teeth, of course, were used, you know, to eat human flesh. So, his teeth out of context were pretty unfortunate for him.
Did people who got to know him report that, you know, upon first seeing him smile, that they were intimidated? I mean, I wonder how much that affected relationships that he tried to make here.
Well, it didn't seem to scare off the ministers who saved him, who rescued him. But I am sure, because of the way he had been depicted as a cannibal savage, that there would be those who would be afraid of him just based on his teeth, and his teeth were eventually capped when he went to Lynchburg. They were either capped right before he went or when he got there, but the people who remembered him said that his teeth were not filed by that point, so they were capped.
I said at the top,
and that would allow him to fit in, mm-hmm. you know, more readily.
I said at the top of the hour, Pamela, that I kept wishing this story were not true. I really wish it had a different ending. Can you tell us about the final day of his life?
Yeah, it's not a happy ending. So those who are looking for a happy ending, I'm sorry. And we should say spoiler alert here, right? If we're going to talk about the end of his life, he did shoot himself in the heart.
And where's he buried?
He's buried in Lynchburg, but there are two different scenarios. We know where he was originally buried, in the city cemetery, which of course was segregated at the time. But oral history suggested that at some point he was reinterred at another cemetery that had become popular among members of the Lynchburg Theological Seminary community. Unfortunately, there were no markers, so there is no way to know where he is buried today. So it's either at that the city cemetery or at the other cemetery that has been so overgrown. People in the community have gone back and tried to clean up the cemetery and try to find any evidence of his whereabouts, but to this day it is not known for sure where his remains are.
What do you know about the fates of the other people that Verner captured and exhibited?
Well, one of them, Condola, He did remain in this country, and he did study and become a minister. He ended up in Memphis, Tennessee, and his life did not seem to go so well either. He never married. He didn't appear to ever have a family. He seemed to live a pretty lonely life in this country.
This story did make me think about what a 180 the field of anthropology has taken. And I'm sure that there is still a lot of misunderstanding that goes on, but it seems that today anthropologists try very hard to understand things in context. How is it that nobody tried at all to understand things in context in the time of Otubenga, just a century ago?
Well, that was the beginning of American anthropology anyway. And the people who I think they were trying to understand. They just had a different worldview, and they applied an American way of understanding to people from different countries, different contexts. So, you know, with the St. Louis World's Fair, what they were trying to do was map human progress from the lowest to the highest. So at the time, anthropologists really did believe that the most civilized people were Europeans and Northern Europeans, and the least civilized were Africans, and the least civilized of all, of course, were so-called pygmies. So this was the thinking of the day.
How long were you working on this? I gather it was a matter of years.
About 4 years.
How do you manage being angry and sad for 4 years every day when you're working on something like this?
You manage. It was quite a roller coaster. I have to say I was really inspired by some of the figures who emerged in this episode. First of all, Reverend Robert MacArthur, a person who's pretty much been lost to history. So I was happy to, you know, bring him back, even at his own church. Many people there don't know about him and should. He was a just an amazing figure of that time. And there were so many people who, like him, who defied the convention of the day to oppose what they saw as a great injustice. So while I was heartbroken, saddened, disgusted sometimes by what had happened to Otubenga and to others, I was also inspired by the courage and the humanity of others who stepped outside of their comfort zone to protest what they had seen.
Pamela Newkirk is professor of journalism at New York University. Her new book is called Spectacle, The Astonishing Life of Otubenga. Pamela, it's been a really interesting hour, and I so appreciate you making this time for us.
Well, thank you. I appreciate it as well.
Think is produced by Stephen Becker and engineered by Shelley Canavy. Lindsay Connect is associate producer, and our executive producer is Jeff Whittington. I'm on Twitter at Chris Boyd Think. The show's email address is think@kera.org. Once again, I'm Chris Boyd. Thanks for listening, and have a great day.